Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Economics Report and American Mosaic, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome back for another As It Is program. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We are here to help you learn and improve your American English. If you are using a computer to hear us, be sure to print the script and then download and save the audio as a podcast. That way, you can go back and listen again and again whenever you like. For today, we talk about the recent presidential elections in Indonesia. Even though the results are complete, the loser says he will offer a challenge. We'll fill you in. Then our attention shifts to Hong Kong and the story of people who live high up on the roofs of buildings. But these residents are not living in expensive penthouses. They are actually living in slums. Details will be coming your way in less than 5 minutes from the Voice of America. Now, here is part one of today's program. The unsuccessful candidate in the Indonesian presidential election has decided to challenge or officially dispute the result. Former Army General Prabowo Subianto will ask the country's constitutional court to overturn the vote count. Christopher Cruz joins us to explain the general's position.
His spokesman announced his decision on Wednesday. The announcement came a day after the country's election commission named former Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo the winner of the July 9th vote. Mr. Subianto said he believes many people were paid to mark their ballots for Mr. Widodo. The former Army General accuses the election commission of failing to investigate accusations of dishonesty. The court is expected to take about a month to consider the case. Most political observers believe General Subianto will not succeed. Edward Aspinall is an expert in Indonesian politics at the Australian National University. He told VOA it would be difficult for the court to overturn a 6-point difference in the vote count.
I think the chances are pretty much close to zero, and there would be no precedent in recent Indonesian electoral history of a constitutional court overturning a result to that extent. The allegations are also, from what we can see, don't seem to be particularly strong.
No violence has been reported following the announcement of the election results. However, thousands of police and military forces have been deployed in case of unrest. Mr. Aspinall says many groups that support Prabowo Subianto have been willing to use violence in the past, but he does not believe they will do so now.
There's a coalition of organizations or people with a background and history of violence on that particular side, so you can never rule it out entirely. But my sense is that the further we go with the process, the chances of that sort of thing begin to diminish, partly because the coalition that coalesced around Prabowo during the election campaign is really starting to disintegrate.
Joko Widodo spoke earlier this week, before the official results were released. The results showed that he won 53% of the vote. He said that now is the time for the country to come together after a difficult campaign.
Kami juga meminta kepada seluruh rakyat Indonesia untuk menjaga.
He said he is certain that the struggle to achieve an Indonesia that is sovereign, independent, and true to its character can only be achieved if we work together. And he said, now is the time to work together. World leaders have already begun congratulating Joko Widodo on his victory. A statement by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the United States looks forward to working with him. Many Indonesians believe Mr. Widodo will reform the country's government. He is one of the few candidates not linked to Suharto, the country's longtime dictator. Suharto was ousted in 1998. He died in 2008. Prabowo Subianto was once married to a daughter of Suharto. The former presidential candidate took strong nationalist positions during the campaign. Many people were worried that he would move the country away from rights of personal freedom. He has been accused of rights abuses. They include permitting the arrest of democracy activists during his time as an army general. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Rising housing prices in Hong Kong are hurting low-income residents. Many people who live in the city are being forced into unsafe and illegal living conditions. Some Hong Kong residents have built low-cost dwellings on the roofs, top levels of high buildings. They may pay rent, make periodic payments, for these poor living spaces to owners they do not trust. The dwellings have poor protection against extreme heat and other dangerous weather. And the city government cannot meet the growing need of affordable public rental housing. Su Xingyun makes her home in a rooftop living space. She says she does not have the money to pay for better places.
The rent is so high out there. How can we leave this place? It costs at least several hundred dollars. We cannot afford it.
Her two daughters have to walk up and down 10 levels of steps on their way to school and back home. They often do their homework in very high heat or under a leaking roof. They share a single bed, a small living room, and another area outside. The open-air space serves as both a kitchen and a bathroom. The roof offers little privacy because it shares the space with similar places. The family of Su Xingyun has lived here for 4 years, but now the government says they must leave. Su Xingyun moved here from mainland China to join her husband. He has lived on the rooftop for 20 years. She said she has requested safer public housing every year.
During a typhoon, I'm really afraid. I'm worried that the roof will collapse because I can feel the walls shaking. It's not safe for a family.
On a rooftop in the working-class Sham Shui Po neighborhood, some residents own their homes. Others pay rent to the landlord. Quang Xuan is a Vietnamese refugee who has lived there for 10 years. He pays about $130 a month.
I will stay as long as they don't demolish this place. If they do, I will have to leave, and I may have to sleep in the streets.
A growing number of new, costly apartments are being built in Hong Kong. Some of them sell for more than $50 million. And as housing prices rise, the city is having difficulty finding rooms for its poorest people. Community worker Angela Liu says many people cannot pay for even Hong Kong's cheapest places to live.
When you want to rent a subdivided unit in urban city, what you need is a deposit, the commission, the first month rent, and altogether can be more than 10,000. It is a little bit a big number, big amount of money that the family under poverty can't afford.
No exact record of the number of poor rooftop homes exists. Officials said they removed 400,000 unlawful buildings, including rooftop dwellings, between 2001 and 2011. Most were removed for safety reasons. They are being torn down faster than the government can place people in homes they can afford. At the same time, the waiting list for public housing is getting longer. At the end of March of this year, there were almost 250,000 requests for public rental housing. The housing department said the average waiting period is 3 years. You are listening to the Voice of America. We're coming to you from Washington.
The Economics Report is next, followed by American Mosaic. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. India's new government is developing a plan to increase economic growth, which has fallen to its lowest level in nearly 20 years. The government, led by the Bharatiya Janata Party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, is expected to be more friendly to business. And it has promised greater chances for foreign investors. Finance Minister Arun Jaitley recently presented the new government's first budget. He said the government will work to increase growth after the Indian economy grew at only 5% each of the past 2 years. Mr. Jaitley presented the annual budget 6 weeks after the Bharatiya Janata Party came to power. The party is trying to find chances for the 1 million people who enter the workforce every year. Mr. Jaitley said the new budget would set the government on a path to higher economic growth.
The steps I will announce in this budget are only the beginning of a journey towards a sustained growth of 7 to 8% or above within the next 3-4 years.
Indian and foreign investors closely watch the government's first budget. They wanted to see if Prime Minister Modi could raise business support in the country. He had been popular with the business community in Gujarat state, where he served as chief minister. The government did announce several economic reforms to show that it plans to aid business. It raised limits for investors in two important industries, defense and insurance. The limits will increase from 26% to 49%. India is the world's largest arms buyer. The government promised a bigger part for private industry as the country tries to improve its roads, railroads, airports, and other infrastructure. It also announced measures to help manufacturing. The government says it will establish a simplified goods and services tax. The tax is meant to make it easier to do business across the country's 29 states. Finance Minister Jaitley sought to ease investor concerns. The former government had raised tax claims of billions of dollars on several companies after changing tax laws to affect past income. The finance minister also promised to control government spending. Mr. Jaitley said he will limit the budget deficit to 4.1%. After its election victory, the government now is under pressure to bring economic results. And that's the VOA Learning English Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter. We'll be right back.
Welcome to American Mosaic from VOA Learning English. I'm June Sims. Today on the show, we listen to some protest music of the past. But first, we tell about a new play in New York that explores the effects of an all-too-common tragedy in America. Americans recently dealt again with school violence. In April, a student in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, took knives to school and stabbed 21 people. There have also been several school shootings in the United States in 2014. New York theatergoers now have a chance to explore the emotions surrounding such events. Christopher Cruz reports.
The Library is a new play at New York's Public Theater. It tells about what happens after a school shooting. It examines the broken lives of survivors. The play is directed by Oscar winner Steven Soderbergh. Scott Z. Burns is the playwright. Even before the play begins, Soderbergh and Burns create unease among theatergoers. As they enter, they see a young woman in a hospital gown in the middle of the stage. She is lying on what could be a bed or a table. She could be in the hospital or in a morgue, where dead bodies are kept for examination. Playwright Burns explains.
People start having to invent a story, you know, which is she alive? Is she not alive?
The young woman on the stage is playing a teenage character named Caitlin Gabriel. She has survived a deadly shooting attack at her high school. One of the other survivors has accused Caitlin on television of telling the gunman where several victims were hiding. 17-year-old film actress Chloe Grace Moretz plays Caitlin.
And so Caitlin Gabriel wakes up out of her induced coma, basically. And she finds out right then and there that not only is her best friend that she was laying beside dead, but that she is now being accused of being an accomplice to the murder of 6 children and 1 faculty member.
As the characters attempt to learn the truth, each of them, children and parents, try to control what is reported about the attack. Director Steven Soderbergh has seen that happen after real school attacks.
We were fascinated by not only the idea of competing stories that have to do battle, but also another story or another myth that often comes out of events like these is that somehow everyone who goes through a tragedy is somehow ennobled by it.
It was the story of one survivor of the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado that led Scott Z. Burns to write the play. 2 Columbine students killed 12 of their classmates and a teacher. Burns says shortly after the attack, misinformation about victims and survivors began to spread.
And so when stories get out, you know, especially now when we have a lot of unfiltered media that finds its way into our eyes and ears very quickly after these things, it's hard to get it back.
The gunman is not central to the Library. The character that could be considered oppositional is the mother of one of the victims. She deals with her loss by writing a book and advising on a film. Both works show her daughter as a hero. The book and movie also accuse Caitlin of leading the gunman to other victims. As new information is communicated about the characters and events, director Steven Soderbergh says audience members begin to question their own beliefs.
two, one, two, three, four.
This week marked the 39th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. On April 30th, 1975, United States Marines removed the last Americans from the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. It brought to a close America's most divisive foreign conflict. This anger and distrust was expressed in protests and songs. Bob Doty has more.
The Vietnam War took place at an unusual time in American history. A record number of Americans gave birth from 1946 to 1959. The largest part of that so-called baby boom came to fighting age when the war began. The baby boomers had also created a youth culture that had fully developed by that time. That culture was based largely on music. When public opinion turned against the war, so did popular songs.
War! Good God, y'all!
What is it good for?
Absolutely!
Now get
sad again!
War!
America's involvement in the war began slowly. There were only 5,000 soldiers in the East Asian country in 1960. But the protest movement in music was already beginning.
Oh, my buddy's dying. So much pain and woe. Oh, God, please bring this awful war to a close.
U.S. military was not all volunteer then as it is now. In 1962, the government established the Selective Service, usually called the draft. The number of American armed service members in Vietnam rose sharply. Leslie Waffen is the retired head of the Motion Picture, Sound, and Video Department at the National Archives. He is also an expert on the music of the Vietnam War.
When you registered for the Selective Service System, you were assigned a draft number, and if your number came up, then you were in the Army.
And when it came my time to serve, I knew better dead than red. But when I got to my old draft board, buddy, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school and I'm a-working in a defense plant. I got a dislocated disc and a racked up back, I'm allergic to flowers and bugs. And when the bombshell hits, I get epileptic fits and I'm addicted to 1,000 drugs. I got the weakness.
That song is Draft Dodger Rag. A draft dodger is someone who flees or refuses the order to join the military. Draft Dodger Rag was a very important, influential song. It was recorded by many folk singers and groups. And the lyrics were filled with ways to dodge the draft. Another draft dodging song came from David Crosby. Draft Morning is mainly about the unfairness of the draft. Mr. Waffen says The Creedence Clearwater song, Fortunate Son, is also about unfairness. Talks about wealthier young Americans who did not have to take part in the war. One way a man could avoid the draft was by going to college. The U.S. president and the American generals in Vietnam told Americans that the U.S. was winning the war. But in January 1968, North Vietnamese soldiers attacked positions deep inside South Vietnam. The targets included the U.S. Embassy. The offensive was crushed quickly, but still, Americans started to question what their government was reporting about the war.
Way down yonder in Vietnam, put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. We're all gonna die. Now come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this is war, a go-go. There's plenty good money to be made. Supplying the army with the tools of the trade. Just hope and pray that if they drop the bomb, they drop it on a Viet Cong. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7.
Fixin' to Die Rag was performed by Country Joe and the Fish at the three-day music festival called Woodstock in New York State in 1969. Les Waffen says the song was powerful.
It became extremely popular as a song that said everything about the public's antagonism against the war, and it sort of reflected what public opinion was all about.
More importantly, Waffen says the song became popular among U.S. soldiers fighting in Vietnam.
There would be DJs in certain zones who would set up their own radio station and begin to broadcast the songs that you were not going to hear on Armed Forces Radio.
Naturally, there were some songs that supported the war. In 1965 and 1966, The Ballad of the Green Berets was a number one song in America.
From the Green Beret, silver wings upon their chest. These are men, America's best.
Some songs that celebrated soldiers also criticized men who found ways not to fight, like Bob Seger's The Yellow Beret.
Cowards of the USA, bravely here at home they stay. They watch their bread.
America is a place of differing opinions. It is also a place where people can express those opinions, even if they go against the government, even when the country is at war.
2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
June Sims. Join us again next week for American Mosaic from VOA Learning English.